Would have loved that story. Roz's brother. My relationship with my brother Richard has always been a tough one to explain. People just don't get it. And watching someone wrap their head around it has always been, well, fun. With the exception of a year and a half when I went off to college and then moved to New York City, we've lived together. Even now, as full-on adults, we still live together. We've spent our entire lives together. We don't fight and we rarely disagree on anything, even though for the most part, we're total opposites. I don't know a life where I couldn't sit on my couch and yell, "Rich!" at the top of my lungs and have him not answer. He's just always been there. He's never judged me or made me eat shit for any of my mistakes, and he's always been around to pick my ass up when I fall. I'd like to say he's the perfect older brother, the kind you only read about in books, but the reality is nobody would ever find our relationship believable. I've never seen or read anything like it. He never resented only being referred to as Roz's brother when I was the popular one, and now he gets a total kick out of whenever someone finds out he's my brother and he's the Richard I tell stories about on the radio. Yep, that's me, Roz's brother. Our mom and dad put a lot on him when we were kids. When I was 2 and he was 5, he was in charge of me. It was his hand I held when we walked across the street, and he was the one who'd slap mine if I tried to stick it into a light socket. Our parents gave him equal power when it came to making sure I didn't kill myself, and they gave him free rein to clobber me when I tried. When he was around, I was his responsibility. This was something that would either make him resent me for the rest of his life or make us form a bond that would to this day be hard for people to fathom. That was the chance our parents took. I'd like to think they knew what they were doing, but now that I'm a dad myself, I can confidently say they did not. There's no way they could have. All they did was remind us that we were brothers and that meant something. It meant everything. It meant that we needed to be accountable to each other even more than we needed to be to them. My brother was the first person to notice my tics, years before I'd be diagnosed with Tourette's. He called me twitchy. We spent so much time together that we'd go on these long stretches where mine was the only non-parent face he saw. If I was having a particularly bad tic day with lots of eye rolling, blinking, and eyebrow raising, he'd ask me if I was taking snapshots. There were times I'd really be in the zone playing guitar, like in a deep fog, ticking like crazy while trying to work through something like Number the Beast by Iron Maiden. And he'd yell, "Hey, Twitchy," to break my concentration. "Yeah," I'd say as I snapped out of it. "You all right?" "Yeah, why?" "Nothing. Just checking." And that was that. Neither of us knew what the twitching was or if it was even a thing. So for the most part, we just ignored it. Rich was the artist. I was the rock star. That's who we were at home. Those were our reputations at school. These were our dreams. I'd sit at one corner of the basement playing guitar, and he'd be at the other end drawing. Even as a kid, he was the best artist anyone had ever met. I've never met anyone like him. I've never met anyone who turned the thing that they were best at when they were 5 years old into a career they've done for their entire life. You'd hear stories like this with guys who were great at hockey or a young singer who crushed it on Star Search and went on to become famous. But this stuff wasn't an option for kids like us. Not in the town we grew up in anyway. For Rich, there was one path and one path only. From that first day before I was even born, when he opened his first box of crayons, that was it for him. He traveled in a straight line from being the talented and sometimes weird art kid, always covered in marker and paint, to being an incredible sculptor, character artist, and animation director who's done Emmy-nominated stuff for PBS and shows for Netflix and just about every other platform that runs cartoons. As far as I can remember, he's only had one job his entire life that didn't have him at a desk drawing. And of course, we did that job together. We did everything together. In our town, when you were a broke, underage kid who needed a little bit of pocket money, your options for summer work were slim. So, just like Kevin Bacon in Footloose, we took jobs at the flour mill. Pest control and maintenance is what they called it. But really, what we were hired to do was kill rats and possibly each other. We weren't old enough to work legally, so this was a cash-at-the-end-of-the-day deal. The basement at the old flour mill was no place for a kid. Dirt floors, low ceiling, moldy piles of wet flour, and rats. Tons of rats. The rats were the problem, and we were the solution. We were handed a shovel, a BB gun, and two pairs of old steel-toe boots that were about three sizes too big for each of us. Our boss explained that half the job was done already, and whoever was here before us had already nailed plywood sheets against the lower half of the dirt walls. He taught us how to mix a bucket of concrete and showed us where to pour it. So, the holes in those walls are where the rats live, and you guys are going to pour new walls with that concrete, he instructed us. One of you guys needs to dig the holes, and the other one needs to pour the bucket into the gap. Once you start digging, and as soon as that shovel hits that wall, those rats are going to come screaming out of there. That's what the gun is for. If they're too big for the gun, that's what the boots are for. So that's what we did. We stomped, shot, and smashed rats with a shovel for $4 an hour. Once all the rat work was done, which took about 4 days, we were allowed out of the basement and into the sunshine. The flour mill was right across the street from Fairy Lake, so there was always a breeze filled with that smell that all small-town lakes have, a combo of moss, fish, and goose shit. But we were excited to get outside and do some work wearing our own shoes that didn't involve killing things with our feet. Our boss took us up to the top of one of the huge silos out back. Getting there was a trip, a few flights of stairs, and then a ride up the man lift, which was this revolving vertical ladder that went up and down between the floors that you would hop on and off like a ski lift. Grab a handle, hook your foot in a loop, and up you went. Once you were on the roof, there were three catwalks that led to each of the silos. These have already been primed. Now they need to be painted, our boss told us. Rich and I stood near the edge and looked down. It was a long drop with no railing. Paint what? My brother asked. Our boss looked at us like we were idiots, like he always did, then looked down, all the way down. He didn't want us to paint the top of the silo. He was asking us to paint the side. We were 60 feet up, and there was no ladder. Grab that, he told Rich and pointed to a pile of rope. Bring it here. As he instructed my brother on how to safely tie the rope off to the edge of the metal catwalk, I stood there trying not to shit myself, wishing we were back in the basement shooting rats. On the other end of the rope, there was a lawn chair. Not a fancy lawn chair, just a lawn chair. One of those white plastic stackable ones that you can pick up for under $10 just about anywhere. Across the seat of it was a 5-foot piece of 2x4 attached with more rope with a paint can hanging off each end. You probably want to stay up here, our boss told my brother. Put your feet here, brace them against this, and lower him down. Him was me. When he's done a little bit, unwind more of the rope and lower him down a bit more. He was now wrapping the rope around one of those things you use to wind up a garden hose on the side of your house. Safety first, he told us. Safety third, I mumbled back. When he gets to the bottom, he can jump off and take the man lift back up and help you pull the chair back up here. You guys can switch off if you want, but I wouldn't. He doesn't look like he can hold you. He told us where the extra paint was and where to clean the brushes at the end of the day, and then he bailed. For the next 30 minutes, we just stood there, looking off the side and then back at the lawn chair. Rich picked up the rope a few times, then put it back down. We're not doing this, he finally said. I was relieved, but to be honest, had he said, all right, hop on, I would have. That's how much I trusted him. I never wanted to disappoint him. Follow me, he told me as he turned around and made his way across the catwalk. We're going home. What are you going to say? We're quitting, he shot back. Yeah, but what are we going to say? Aside from soccer before the season even started, neither of us had ever quit anything before. We'd never stood up to an adult before or told someone to go fuck themselves. We hadn't ever made it clear that we were not going to stand for something or that we deserved to be treated better than this. This was our moment, and I was excited. Don't worry about what we're going to say, he replied. And I didn't. I just trusted him. We walked down and out the side door, then made our way across the gravel parking lot. Our boss was alone, smoking a cigarette beside his truck. It was hot as hell that day, so his t-shirt was off and hanging out of the back pocket of his cut-off jean shorts. He looked pissed off and sweaty. As we got a little closer, he and my brother locked eyes, and Rich started walking faster. I thought for sure he was going to run up and drop-kick that guy's ass into the creek behind him. I'd never seen Rich like this before. When we were finally all face-to-face, our boss went from looking annoyed to absolutely concerned. "What's the matter? What happened?" he said as he took his t-shirt out of his back pocket and handed it to my brother to wipe his tears with. "Wait, what?" I looked at Rich and he was bawling, tears raging out of his eyes, snot out of his nose, and he was hyperventilating. "What happened?" our boss asked again. Catching his breath and fighting to get the words out, Rich told him the story. "Before we started painting, we went back down to the office to get our drinks out of the fridge, and I called our mom to say that we were going to be a little bit late today. She told me that one of our friends in Georgetown was riding his bike and got hit by a car." I didn't know what I was watching, but I went along with it, nodding along while unsuccessfully trying to whip up a few fake tears of my own. Rich was spinning a story with such incredible detail that I almost started to believe it. What our friend's injuries were, what the doctors were saying, how long this poor kid lay in a ditch before somebody finally found him. It was a hit and run. The cops were involved. The kid might die. We need to leave. Neither of us had any friends in Georgetown. When Rich was coming up with this story, in that short time we had before he reached our boss, I'm guessing he wanted to make sure there was no chance this guy would force us to stay, and there was certainly no way he was going to let that asshole call me a pussy for not wanting to get in that chair. We were leaving, and we were leaving now, so that's the story my brother came up with, and it worked. Rich is the smartest person I've ever met. It took me a lot of years to realize I wasn't smart. Like, not at all. I pretty much cruised through school on charm, charisma, and really great hair. Later in life, I had a couple of wild awakenings where I understood just how not smart I was, when I realized all the things I didn't know, which was a shit ton. I did a lot of my education later in life. I was a C-minus product of the public school system and only made it out because teachers didn't want to fail me. I was a terrible student, but it didn't matter because I decided I was going to be famous. Actually, I was already famous back then. It's just that nobody knew it yet. I was raised on teen sex comedies, metal, and the glamorization of the American shopping mall. I was a rock star. I looked the part, acted the part, had the clothes, the big hair, the girls, and the attitude. The problem was I was never good enough to even make a dent in music, and I was too terrified to ever step on a stage. Rich was not a rock star. Rich was a nerd. And I say that respectfully with my whole heart. And if he were reading this, I'm sure he'd agree with me. He's still a nerd. And to a certain extent, I guess I'm still that little rock star. We're both older versions of those two inseparable kids that were each other's best friend and biggest fan. The two kids that knew the only way we were ever going to make it was if we made it together. In the mid-1980s, our parents made a catastrophic error, a mistake that almost tore our family apart. They wanted to be a bit closer to work, so they decided to move us out of our small town to the sprawling suburbs just outside of Toronto, a big city. This was the waterbed house. I was in grade 5 and Rich was in 8. We'd have to go to two different schools because they didn't have a junior high out there. So I went to the primary school and he went to the high school. I wasn't happy, but I adjusted fine enough and did what I normally did. Found an older girlfriend and spent our afternoons dry humping on the pullout couch in her basement. Then I'd go home and play guitar and watch wrestling videos alone in my room. Her name was Chloe. She dressed like Madonna, wasn't a virgin, and her family was weird. She had two older brothers who used to eat her parents at a house and home. So every day before her parents left for work, they'd leave three pieces of white bread and a jar of Cheese Whiz on the kitchen table, then wrap a huge chain around the fridge and padlock it shut. Then they'd run wire cable through all the handles on every cupboard in the kitchen and lock them too. Nobody was getting into anything. I remember they had an old dog whose name was also Chloe. And the weird thing was, they had the dog before they had her. She was named after the dog. Chloe and I were together for about 6 months, and then she cheated on me and dumped me for an older kid across the street named Carlos Ferrari. Let me just make something clear right now. Most of the names in this book have been changed. Some of them aren't even close to the real ones. But Carlos Ferrari was this dude's real name, and I'm using it on the off chance he reads this one day. I hope he reads this. I want him to know I still think he's a dick for doing what he did. I have very few memories of actually being in the waterbed house. It's one of the parts of my life filled with holes, questions, and blank spaces. I don't have one single memory of sitting down to eat as a family or watching a movie together. I don't remember laughing, where our kitchen was, or where we put up the Christmas tree. I do remember feeling isolated, though. Our parents knew Rich and I hated it there, so they got us waterbeds. Yep, that was their big solution. Like, waterbeds would fix everything. Then they got us our own TVs, and when we got home from school, we would both disappear into separate rooms. We didn't have a finished basement to hang out in anymore, and I don't remember feeling anything other than detached. We weren't us in that house. The move was a mistake. At first, my brother and I looked at this move as an adventure, a fresh start, a chance to be someone new, and for him, a total reinvention. Family Ties was the biggest show on television, and Michael J. Fox as Alex P. Keaton was a legend. My brother loved that guy. So much so that on his first day of school, he showed up in a dark blue three-piece suit with his binders in a brown leather briefcase. This was his new look. This was the new Richard. He was the kid who showed up to a city school with no friends in a three-piece suit. But he wasn't Alex P. Keaton. He was a target. Students and teachers bullied him. It was merciless and never-ending. It was violent. Even when he ditched the suit and tried to disappear, it was still brutal. I do have two very clear memories of that house, and only two. The first was watching the Space Shuttle Challenger explode on live television. And the second was the day Rich came home one afternoon and told me he was running away. I was in my room watching TV before our parents came home, and Rich walked in crying. These were real tears, not like in the parking lot that day at the flour mill. And as soon as I saw him upset, I started crying. I didn't know what was going on, but I could tell he hadn't been to school that day. He sat on my floor with me and opened up his school bag. He was carrying a couple of changes of clothes, a bit of allowance money, and a few family pictures that he pulled from the albums from downstairs. Three of the photos were of me and him. I don't know all the details or what led him to want to run away. That's not my story to tell. But I did get the sense that he came back that day to say goodbye to me. I knew what was happening. "What are you doing?" I remember asking. "I just can't anymore," he answered without looking at me. Now, over the years, I've needed my big brother thousands of times. Too many to even count. This, I can truthfully say, was one of the very few times he needed me. He's always been my protector and the guy who never judged me. He picked me up when I fell, but in that moment, and for the first time, with the two of us in tears on my bedroom floor with our backs up against that goddamn waterbed, he needed me. I remember pulling his bag away from him and tucking it under my arm. Then I reached out and grabbed his hands. "No," I said, while bawling and shaking my head back and forth. "Please, no, don't." I don't know if what I said helped. Knowing Rich, I think he stayed because he was the big brother, and he didn't want to leave me. I'm not sure when or how much he told my parents, but within a few months, they listed the house and we moved back to Acton. My mom called the school principal back in Acton and asked if my brother could attend their grade 8 graduation, even though he hadn't attended that school for a single day that year. My mom knew that Rich needed a win, and so did his old school. We moved back to town, Rich got to graduate with all his old friends, and we all pretended that that time away never happened. We were home. After that, my brother and I spent every second of every day in our new basement, drawing and playing guitar while coming up with the perfect plan to get the hell out of that stupid small town again. Together. 13 going on 14. I didn't really know much about cocaine when I was 13. Why would I? Sure, I'd seen coke plenty of times in movies, heard it referenced in the odd song, and knew it was on Nancy Reagan's list of shit she told us to just say no to. But I didn't really know what it did or how you did it. And I certainly didn't know that if someone does too much of it, their face can literally explode, that blood would come gushing out of their nose, fill their mouth, ruin their shirt, and fuck up the rug they were standing on. That in a matter of seconds, someone's face can turn from beautiful, fun, and flirty with perfect lipstick and a gorgeous smile to looking like it just got hit with a bat. That's exactly what happened to Missy 20 minutes before we had sex for the first time, which was also 20 minutes before I had sex for the first time, while my dad waited for me outside in the family car. Going through my class pictures from about grade 2 to 8 is almost comical. You never have to look too hard to find me because I'm in the same spot year after year. Back row center. That spot was always reserved for the tallest kid in class. That was my spot. I was the tallest kid in the whole damn school. In grade 8, I was just over 6 feet. I towered over everyone and was taller than most of my teachers. 2 weeks after school started that year, the principal of my junior high had to call the high school up the street where my brother went to get them to send over 6 high school-sized desks and chairs so I'd have a place I could sit in all my classes. "Here you go, you're all set," I remember my homeroom teacher telling me as he smiled and pointed to my new desk. All my desks were now in the very back row of all my classrooms. I didn't get to pick who I wanted to sit beside anymore because the priority now was making sure I wasn't blocking someone else's view. Sure, I was finally comfortable, but man, I felt like shit about it some days. I still do. I'm still hyper aware of blocking someone's view, getting in their space, or ruining their night. I haven't willingly sat in the middle row at a movie theater in my entire life. I usually grab any available aisle seat and turn my body so my big head doesn't block the person behind me. I don't enjoy going to the movies, and I hate having anyone behind me. Being that tall and looking so much older, people just assume stuff about me. People either thought I was older, or because I looked older, they thought I'd be able to handle things that other kids couldn't. This was why guys double my age would think I was a fair fight, and why grown women would flirt with me or grab at me and say shit that you just shouldn't say to a kid who's 13 going on 14. Men would see me as a threat, and women would sometimes look at me like lunch. We don't ever really discuss sexualizing young men, and we sure as hell didn't back then. Today, when it comes to girls, we know what to do and we shut it down. We know just how bloody damaging it is to sexualize young girls, even when we fail as a society to protect them. Courageous people with lots of fight in them have battled for decades to change that dynamic for young girls. As a father, I am part of that battle now. But for boys, or at least for me, it was easier to just become the thing people thought I was than it was to fight back. So that's what I did. Most times, I just became the person everyone expected. But other times, every now and then, I'd use looking older to my advantage, like to get into places I shouldn't be. Midsummer, the year before grade 8, a friend of a friend named Ryan caught wind of a teen bar 40 minutes out of town called Club 404 or 606 or something oh something. I don't remember. The legend was that this place was a headbanger's paradise. Loud music, a dance floor, cheap Pepsi, and tons of out-of-town girls with a McDonald's in the same parking lot. Paradise. They didn't serve alcohol, but you still had to be 16 to get in, which for me was never going to be a problem. I looked the part. I think on normal nights, Club 404 or whatever was a regular bar for grown-ups, but one night a week, they did this teen night between 7 and 10. Putting the guest list together was a challenge because not everyone I knew could pass for 16, and if one of us got popped trying to sneak in, we were all going down and none of us were getting in. The first time we went, Ryan and I roped in a third tall kid, convinced my dad that this place was specifically for kids our age, and got him to drive us. Well, my old man sat in the car smoking cigarettes and reading the paper. We partied hard. We were rock stars in that place. Three skids who could clear the dance floor and headbang the hardest every time AC/DC played. One night, we formed a circle with a dozen or so out-of-town skids when You Shook Me All Night Long came on. Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a girl off to the side by the table staring at me. After a few head whips and hair flips, I looked back to see if she was still there. She was, only now she was smiling. We locked eyes and stared at each other. I was paralyzed. I stood there, trying not to break eye contact while in the middle of teenage heavy metal mayhem. She started doing something with her hands over and over, motioning towards me and then waving me over. I wasn't sure what she was doing, but she kept doing it as I made my way across the dance floor. When I got close enough, she reached out, grabbed me, and hugged me like we were best friends. I was so confused. I was convinced she thought I was someone else. But then she introduced herself. "You're fucking tall," she said as she let her arms go from around my shoulders. "I'm Missy." "I'm Ross." "What was that?" I asked. "That thing with your hands." "It was sign language. I know sign language." I didn't really know what to do with that, so I said, "Cool," and dropped it and moved on. "Are you from here? Do you live around here? Do you come here all the time? It's awesome, huh? How old are you?" I was burning through all my prime questions because I was nervous as hell. Missy didn't look like any girl who'd ever hugged me before. She felt different. She hugged different. "I'm out of here in a few months," she said. "They won't let me back in after I'm 19, so too old for this place." She said that like I could relate. Then she grabbed my hand and pulled me in tight and led me over to introduce me to her friends. One guy named Dude Rude, who looked like a chubby David Lee Roth, and another guy named Vlad, who's about 6'7", hairy as hell, and told me that he was the leader of a gang called The Law. I thought that sounded stupid and made up, but I didn't say anything. I didn't want to blow it. Missy wrapped her arm around my waist and walked us away from the group. "Don't you want to know what I was saying when I was signing?" she asked. "Yeah, oh my God, for sure. What?" I shot back quickly. "I said I want you." "Jesus Christ." Then I said, "Come here," and now you're here. I was frozen. "How old are you?" she asked, and without even taking a breath, I leaned in and whispered the word 17 into her ear. A few minutes later, we were alone in the back of the bar, in the dark, at one of the tables nobody ever sat at, making out. And that's what we'd do for the next two Fridays while my friends headbanged and my dad waited outside in the parking lot, smoking cigarettes and reading the paper. I became the person she hoped I was, the person she expected. Right around the time Missy was turning 19, I convinced my dad to drive me a half hour out of town to a friend's place. I don't remember exactly who I said she was or how I knew her, but I was a trustworthy and convincing kid. Plus, I said her parents would be home, so it wasn't really a problem. I got the address, gave it to my dad, and scheduled a time for him to pick me up. I knew he wasn't going far, so there was no way he was going to be late getting me. I had 2 hours. Missy answered the door. This wasn't her house, she told me, but sometimes I stay here. She was wearing the same white blazer and black stretch pants she was wearing at the bar the week before. I think her t-shirt was different, but her socks were definitely the same. Thick, green, and wool. The kind you'd find if you were digging around an army surplus store. Missy introduced me to her friend and said that this was her place, which I already knew because her living room was covered in framed family photos. It was clear that the friend's parents were not home. We spent the next hour or so sitting in their living room listening to music. These two were on a completely different level from me. They were fucking loud and all over the place. There was no making out, and when Missy did sit beside me, she would just squeeze my hand, close her eyes, and sway back and forth. I didn't really know what I was doing there or why I was invited. Missy seemed like she didn't give a shit, but she looked beautiful doing it. As the two girls danced around the living room and made their way into the attached dining room singing Bon Jovi at the top of their lungs, I sat on the couch mouthing along to Wanted Dead or Alive, trying to fit in. Then the singing stopped, and all I heard was fuck, 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 Missy, too much blow, fuck. I shot up from the couch. They'd been in the other room for maybe 2 minutes, but when I ran in, Missy had her t-shirt pulled up over the front of her face while her friend had her hands cupped under Missy's chin trying to catch the blood. Missy saw me standing there and just said, I'm sorry. Her friend pointed her bloody hand at me and then at the couch and shouted, sit, don't move. 15 minutes later, Missy came back into the living room wearing only a towel. Her hair was soaking wet and brushed back. Her makeup was washed off, and she was out of breath, exhausted. I'm sorry, she said again, as she put out her hand and pulled me up off the couch. I said nothing. I had nothing to say. She led me upstairs to her friend's bedroom, closed the door behind us, and walked me over to the bed. 15 minutes later, I was in the car with my dad. All right, y'all set, dude? My dad asked as I slid into the passenger seat. Yeah, Pop, all set. I blurted out, trying to seem enthusiastic and normal as I attempted to put the pieces together and process what the hell just happened in there. Hey, what did you guys do? He asked me as he gave me two fist bumps on my knee to get my attention, which was probably the second or third time he asked that same question without getting an answer from me. Yeah, it was fun. Listened to music, hung out, played ping pong in the basement, stuff like that. Cool parents. The ride home was awful. I could tell my dad knew something was up. He didn't know what, but he sure as hell knew something. I knew that most of what just happened in there was eventually going to come out over the dinner table with him, my mom, and my brother. I couldn't remember all of it, but what I did remember was going to come out. It's what our family did. During that time, I was pretty much living a double life. Half of me was juggling the lies and cover-ups of my relationship with Missy. Well, the rest of the time, I was just kicking it, doing normal kid stuff. I played with wrestling dolls, rode bikes, listened to metal, and hung out in Ethan's basement playing darts and watching his older brother's porno. Normal kid stuff. Ethan and I started hanging out just before the end of grade 7, right before summer. He lived down the street and had one of those basements that mothers of young boys never went down to. The most you'd get was yelled at from the top of the stairs when dinner was ready or if she needed you to flip the laundry. Moms knew better. Ethan made me laugh like no other kid ever did. He's still one of the funniest people I've ever met and the only friend I told the truth to about my relationship with Missy, and he knew everything. On September 24th, 1988, Ethan and I were in his basement getting ready to watch the men's 100-meter finals at the Seoul Olympics. Like everyone else in the country, we were glued. This was the Ben Johnson versus Carl Lewis showdown that we had been waiting weeks for. Up to that point, Ethan and I would bet on the events as they were happening live. Neither of us had any money, so we'd wager things like a Charlie horse punch to the thigh, pouring an entire glass of water into the other guy's ear hole, or having a tennis ball whipped at your nuts if you lost. Stuff like that. Totally normal. For the 100-meter final, we both agreed that this last bet had to be the biggest. High risk, high reward. After picking our favorites to win, I had Ben Johnson, he took Carl Lewis, we both agreed that the loser would have to eat a fart. If you lost, you'd lie down on your back, open your mouth, and let the winner squat over your face and fart right into your mouth. Then you'd have to chew. It wouldn't count if you didn't chew. Ben Johnson won that night in record time, and Ethan made good on our bet. He ate my fart. As I was leaving his place, he asked if I wanted to hang out the next night. Sorry, man, I can't. Sunday nights were Missy nights. On Sundays after 6, you could make long-distance phone calls for half the price, so my mom would let me call Missy for an hour after dinner. On Sundays, I lived that other life. In the next few weeks, Ben Johnson would be stripped of his medal for doping, and they handed it to Carl Lewis. It was the biggest scandal in sports history, and my bet with Ethan became the biggest scandal in friend history. Later that month, Ethan's dad died of a heart attack, suddenly. I remember Ethan took about a month off school, came back for a week or two, and then he was just gone. His mom packed him up and moved him to the West Coast, and he just disappeared. We saw each other briefly one other time, but other than that, we never talked again. The time came, and I sat down with my family at one of our spectacular dinners to tell them everything. That I'd met a new girl, that the club was actually for older kids, and I lied to get in, that I was in love with Missy, that her friends wanted me to join their gang, that we had sex, and that she was 18 going on 19. I somehow thought that if I said she wasn't quite 19 yet, this would lessen the blow a bit. It didn't. "I want you to meet her. I want her to come over," I said. "How old does she think you are?" my mom asked. 17, I replied. "Does she know about me?" my brother asked. "Yeah, of course. I didn't lie about that." "So how old am I supposed to be then? You're still 16. Wait, so now I'm your little brother?" "Yeah, that would be cool if we could go with that," I replied. As a parent, and I say this now as one myself, you play out scenarios in your head all the time. You have conversations and make plans and try to have all the answers and solutions ready to go when your kids come to you looking for advice or ask you to expand your boundaries with trust and freedom. Sleepover camp, a cell phone, or those first relationships, the innocent ones. We prepare for those, and I'm sure my parents had too. But I just told my folks that I had been to the moon on a stolen ticket and I wasn't coming home. They were not prepared for this. "Okay, we'll meet her," my dad said, clearly trying to process all that while keeping his cool. "Bring her over, but no more going there. Understood?" "Yeah, Pop. No problem." I knew what I was asking my family to do was huge. I was asking them all to lie for me, switch our entire family dynamic so my big brother became my little brother, talk to me like I was a senior in high school, and allow me, who just turned 14, to have a much older girlfriend come to the house for sleepovers. And my family did. All of them. For years, I thought it was cool that my parents and my brother went along with it. But as I got older, I realized they were all just terrified. They did their best, right or wrong, not to lose me. There was no going back for me. There was no way to rewind time or pretend none of that was happening. They were afraid I'd leave or run away, take off with Missy and my new, much older friends, that I'd join a stupid gang called the Law, get in trouble, and fuck my future. My family did what they always did. They tried to keep me safe, keep me close, keep me home. For the rest of that fall through winter and into spring, I kept things going with Missy, while my parents and my little brother played right along. We'd talk on the phone for an hour on Sundays, and once, maybe twice a month, she'd come and spend the night when she could borrow a car. The rules were pretty simple in my house. I'd sleep in my room, and she'd get the pullout in the basement. But that never stopped us. We always found time. Missy never really talked about her family, and when she did, she'd flip back and forth between referring to her parents as Mom and Dad and using their real names. She always looked like she was catching herself in a lie, and she'd correct it right after. It was confusing, but I never asked. She always seemed to overpack when she came to my place for the night. She had an old white canvas bag with a broken zipper, and everything was always spilling out of it. For one night at my place, she always packed the same things. Two or three pairs of stretch pants, a few t-shirts, her white blazer, an extra pair of shoes, her makeup bag, and an old pencil case with all her jewelry. This seemed a lot for just one night. But again, I never asked. As the weather started to get warmer, I went through a period of well over a month without seeing her. We'd still talk on the phone on Sundays, but it wasn't the same or enough.
Missy couldn't get a car, and there was no cheap or direct bus that would get her to my place.
I begged my dad to go pick her up, which, after a long conversation with my mother, he agreed to do. What choice did they have? I was going to see her one way or another. While my dad waited in the driveway, I walked up to Missy's front door and rang the bell. I had never been to her place before, and other than her parents' first names, I knew nothing about her family.
When I walked in, the house was absolute mayhem. There were kids everywhere, all different ages, all different races. No two even remotely looked like brother and sister. And her parents were old, like grandparent old. I didn't know anything about group homes or foster care, but Missy did her best to quickly explain it all to me as she led me down the basement stairs to her room. She said this was the fifth place she's lived, and because she was over 18, she's aged out. But she was good with the kids, knew sign language, and helped out with expenses, so her parents were letting her stay a little longer. Missy's bedroom was at the far corner of their unfinished basement. She built herself her own space by hanging bed sheets with thumbtacks onto the wood stud walls. She whipped open one of the sheets and led me in and told me to grab a seat while she packed up. Missy's bedroom was a cot and a sleeping bag on a concrete floor. There was an exposed light bulb above with a shoelace dangling from it. "Cool," I said, not knowing what else to say. "I love it." Missy didn't reply as she frantically gathered up her things and threw them into her white canvas duffel bag with the broken zipper. She wasn't overpacking for one night. She was packing up everything she owned, which I then realized was what she did every time she left. She was on the clock, and this family was temporary, and it was going to be her last. Missy was living a life that I didn't understand, but I didn't ask too many questions or open up. I'd told too many lies, and if we started talking, like actually telling each other things, I would have blown it, and it would be over. By this time, I was a couple of months away from graduating grade 8. These were the last few months in junior high, which sucked because our house was right beside my school. On our street, it went my house, a small parking lot, then my school. I could go home to pee if I wanted to. One afternoon in woodshop, my teacher walked up behind me and told me they were calling me to the office. I left my goggles and gloves on the bench, brushed off the sawdust, and walked out. "Your mom called and wants you to come home," the secretary told me. Mom was working in real estate at the time, so her being home in between showings wasn't unusual. Pulling me out of school early was. "Like right now?" I asked. "Yeah," she said, "to grab your things for the day and head home. She needs you home." The only other time my parents pulled me out of school was when my mom's brother, my Uncle Mac, died years earlier, and we had to drive to Montreal for his funeral. I was terrified. Who died? As I headed across the small parking lot, I saw a car parked in our driveway. It was Missy's car, the one she sometimes borrowed to drive to see me. This wasn't a planned weekend visit. This was a Wednesday afternoon. I was dead. I knew that in less than 100 steps, I was going to walk through that front door to my own funeral. Missy and my mom were sitting at the kitchen table. "Sit down," my mom said without looking at me. "Missy, what do you want to say?" I sat down, right where my mom said to, looked at Missy, caught my breath, and looked away. I never looked back. Her face was covered in tears. "I came to take you for lunch, to surprise you. I went to your school, the high school, and asked the receptionist if she could page you to the office. She told me they didn't have a Roz Weston at the school, but they did have a Richard Weston. She said you were his little brother and went to the junior high school down the street." I don't actually remember Missy saying any of this. I don't remember anything after I sat down right where my mom told me to. My only memory of this conversation, how it all went down, was listening to my mom retell it to my brother when he got home from school, and then again to my dad when he got home from work. I also don't remember what I said or how we decided what we decided next. But after all that, after there were no more lies and the truth was out, Missy and I didn't break up. Reading that probably doesn't make you feel good. It shouldn't. But for me, this was about guilt and survival. Any hurt caused was caused by me. This was all on me. These were my lies. This was my mess, and this was all my fault. I felt incredibly bad that I put my mom through that situation, that now she was a liar too. I was devastated that I had just ruined what was most likely the closest thing to an actual family that Missy had ever known. And I didn't have the maturity or skills to fix any of it. So I just carried on like none of it ever happened.
Grade 8 graduation was coming up, and there was no way I'd be able to take Missy as my date, so I asked a girl in my class named Kathy if she'd go with me. Missy still went to my grad, but she drove there herself and sat in the audience with my parents. Nobody asked who she was. One of the last times I saw Missy, we spent the entire time talking. We'd never really talked before, not without lying anyway. I have tons of holes in my memory of my past, but especially from that year. I don't remember the details of a single one of our Sunday night after six phone calls or how we'd spend our time when she came for those weekends. Even writing this was a fight to try to put the pieces together. It's a blur. So I'm not sure how or why we started talking about it, but the question of what we would do if she ever got pregnant came up. This wasn't something I'd really thought about, but it was obvious Missy had. "You'd never know if I got pregnant," she told me seriously. "I'd just disappear. I'd never ask you to be a part of that. You don't have to worry about that, ever, okay?" That I do remember, because she said that to me, looking straight into my eyes, with one hand on the side of my face. Then she pulled me in and kissed me on the forehead, and that was the end. Missy only spent the night that one last time, and then, just like that, she was gone. I don't remember the last conversation we had, but I certainly know we never said goodbye or officially broke up. She was just gone. I called the house a few times and spoke to her foster parents, left a couple of messages, but I never heard from her ever again. In the years after, while I was still in high school, Missy's name would come up every now and then among my friends, and to be honest, I didn't have enough hands for all the high fives I was giving. I was an absolute legend. But I'd always end the story right before the part of what we'd do if she ever got pregnant. Nobody got the whole truth. Nobody ever got the part that hollowed me out. This is a story I stopped telling when I realized how out of their depths my parents were, how they just tried to manage a complicated and terrifying situation as best they could without losing me. I wonder now how many nights they must have stayed up talking about whether they were doing the right thing or not. I wonder how awful they must have felt. Do I think my parents failed me? No, and I hope you don't either, because there's a real good chance that if they didn't handle that year the exact way they did, I wouldn't be here. They did their best, but like everyone else in my life back then, they probably thought I could handle much more than a kid my age should be able to. As an adult, I can truthfully admit that that year fucked me up. But it was years, decades before I realized it. Did Missy vanish because she was pregnant? I don't know. Is it something I think about all the time, even today? Absolutely. I never wanted Missy to fall in love with me, but I did want to be the person she thought she fell in love with. And that right there is the thing I would repeat, the mistake I would make for most of my life. Every relationship after Missy, I would become the person the other person saw. I would become the thing that they wanted me to be. When someone would describe me to someone else, they would be so off and so wrong, but I didn't know how to be with people my own age or build an honest relationship. Even when I was married, I wasn't really me. I was this person who adapted to be who my then wife and her friends thought I was. Once social media became a thing and I got on television, just about everyone from my past who I was ever friends with reached out in one way or another. Hundreds of people I went to high school with, old teachers, people I used to headbang with, and just about every girl I ever dated connected to say hi. There are, however, two people I've never heard from. Missy's one of them. At least once a year, even now, I'll do a search for her. But her real name is very common, which makes things tough. I just keep replaying that conversation we had over and over. I probably always will. I wish I could tell you Missy was the last woman that I terrified my parents with, but she wasn't. I spent a lot of my high school years bringing home strippers, more girls who did more drugs, and more women years older than me. Again and again, my mom and dad would just do their best, manage the risk, and try to keep me close. I've grown to hate not getting closure, and I absolutely can't stand the feeling of owing anybody anything, I always have to close things out. Debts, favors, relationships. I hate loose ends. The second person who never reached out on social media was Ethan, that friend from grade 8 who I made that bet with. All I know is that even now, with me being a level-headed and totally respectable dad with a big fancy job, if Ethan ever came calling looking for payback, I'd happily close out that debt. I'd eat a fart. The Naked Guitarista. I never burned myself because I felt worthless. It certainly wasn't out of neglect, and I definitely wasn't trying to punish myself. I wasn't taught to suppress emotion. The exact opposite, actually. My dad led with his whole heart and embraced emotions. He was all about clarity and closeness. My parents built a home that was safe, a family who could tell each other anything, and for the most part, we did. My friends loved my parents too, and it wasn't at all unusual for me to come home and see my buddies sitting in our kitchen with mom and dad smoking cigarettes and just shooting the shit. All my friends called my parents mom and dad, while some, the ones who got close, just called my dad D for short. It was a safe house, and nothing any of my friends ever told my parents ever escaped those walls. They'd show up with coffee, and they always knew exactly how my parents took it. My friends could talk to my parents about anything, and they did. Girl problems, school problems, or trouble at home. My mom and dad were so dialed in to what was happening in all their lives that they knew exactly who needed advice, who could use a good kick in the ass or an ego check, and who just needed a place that felt safe to hang for a few hours. Sometimes my friends needed somewhere that felt like home, and that's what our house was for them, a second home. It was nothing for us to have another kid at the dinner table 3 or 4 nights a week, but after so many of those nights around the dining room table, the nights my dad loved, full of those kid stories and uncontrollable laughter, I'd disappear into my room and pull out the cigarette lighter and a small purple box and my mother's sewing needles that I kept hidden in the back of my guitar amp. Nobody who hurts themselves ever does it because they're in a good place. Nobody thinks it's cool to self-harm. Nobody cuts, burns, screams, fucks, or drinks the pain away for the attention. But for me, it was more reward than punishment. It was ritualistic and routine. It became the thing I looked most forward to, even though I knew I'd often hate myself afterwards. It was a compulsion, an addiction, a purpose. Burning myself gave me everything and asked for nothing in return. The snap of the flint off the lighter, watching the end of a needle go from silver to black to red to white. The feeling of my skin popping up in tiny lines and dots when I dragged the tip of it across my body was like a meditation. It was a recharge. I never hurt myself out of anger, and I never slid the end of a hot needle under my toenail because I thought I was a bad person. I did it because the pieces inside me that never felt like they fit together suddenly did. I know this now, but I didn't then. I couldn't articulate it. I didn't have the tools. I couldn't ask for help because I didn't know what I needed help with. I'd go from feeling overwhelmed to feeling nothing. There was never much in between. I was popular, but never felt close enough to anyone to really care one way or another if they walked out of my life and never came back. Some pieces just didn't fit. Burning was never a way to cope with emotions. It was a way to feel them. I had no point of reference for why burning worked, but it did. I wasn't trying to accomplish anything, and there was no nihilistic endgame. To be honest, I didn't know if I was different or completely normal, but I knew that in those moments, I'd feel normal, whatever that was. Having spent so much time with my brother setting up the Cub Scouts Hall for the weekly AA meeting my dad would host and hearing so many stories, I learned 2 things about addicts. The first was that distractions work. That's why so many people in AA smoke, one cigarette right after another. It's a distraction. My brother and I would get there early with my pop on Saturday nights, put the industrial-sized coffee pot on, set up 4 or 5 rows of chairs, and place an ashtray on every other seat. I'd usually fall asleep within the first half hour or so, face down on a folding card table off to the side. I'd wake up 2 or 3 times, when everyone clapped at the end of a speech, when someone got emotional and needed support from the room, or when the entire group would say hi, followed by some stranger's name right after a not-so-anonymous drunk just courageously announced to the room that they, too, were an alcoholic. Those Saturdays were never easy, but I never regretted being there. The second thing I learned was the one universal truth that binds all addicts together. They lie. All addicts lie. I was a great liar, although I tried my best not to. I never wanted to have to lie about my burns, so I hid them. Bottoms of my feet, back of my arms, behind my knees, but mostly the tops of my thighs, and the one place nobody would be able to see unless the lights were on. In those rare moments, when someone did notice, I'd say my scars were from chicken pox when I was a kid or mosquito bites, or I'd cop to having an STD that I didn't have. That was the trade-off. I was far more comfortable with someone spreading a lie that I had herpes than I was telling them the truth. All addicts lie. Playing guitar was my distraction. That's what worked for me. Like all those guys in AA who chain smoked to keep their hands busy long enough to not drink, I'd play guitar long enough to try to feel something. I don't really remember ever crying, but I do remember every single time that I should have cried and didn't. I wasn't anti-emotions or anything like that. I was the exact opposite, actually. I wanted my feelings to all come out in music. I wanted to write love songs, heartbreaking ballads that people would listen to when they got dumped or that kids would slow dance to for the first time in junior high. And to try to get those emotions down in words, I did everything I could. I'd strip myself down to nothing, literally. I'd get naked, light a candle, and sit in the middle of my room in the dark with my cold guitar across my lap, listening and playing along to the saddest music I had, which, at the time, was Sinead O'Connor and my brother's Enya tape. I sat there for hours in my own head, listening to new age emo shopping mall music, trying to cry. And when that didn't work, I turned my amp around, grabbed that little purple box of needles, and my cigarette lighter. For me and the guys I hung out with, most of our teen years were spent fighting off boredom. We didn't have a ton of options in Acton. There was no mall or movie theater, and going to McDonald's on a Saturday was a plan you made on Wednesday because it took 2 or 3 days to find someone who was able to borrow their parents' car to make the trip to Georgetown. Avoiding boredom was just what we did, no matter how much it hurt. The first time I burned myself, it was on a dare. I was showing off. That night, one brutally humid July evening in about 1990, there was a house party down the street from our place. And believe me, when I say house is a major overstatement. Imagine handing a 17-year-old the keys to a converted garage and saying, "This is yours now. Go nuts." That was Scott's place. There was a mattress on the floor, a half dozen stolen lawn chairs, a hot plate, and a mini fridge. The walls were 6 different shades of plaster and primer and covered in holes from fists, heads, and beer bottles being thrown at a red target that was spray-painted just beside the back door. Scott was a big, tough, sometimes violent, and very misunderstood town heavy. He was a fighter. His mom lived in the main part of the house and didn't give a fuck what he did. I didn't know what happened to Scott's dad, why his half-brother was in prison, or why his mom didn't care what he got up to. Nobody knew. I always found it strange that none of this was ever acknowledged. Nobody bothered to ask. They all just got drunk at his place and threw shit through his walls. It was weird. We really shouldn't have been friends, but we just developed this thing. He was obsessed with the military and knew my dad was a Marine. He respected that, and I suppose he respected me because of that. Scott was hard inside and out, but when you needed him, like when someone was going to kick your ass, he was a pretty good friend to have around. We never had any deep moments, never talked about feelings or secrets, and when he'd ask me to go with him to the emergency room because he'd sliced his own arm open with a hunting knife or broke his hand on a wall, I never asked why. I never needed a reason, and he'd never volunteer one. He didn't have to let me in, and I was fine with that. That's why I'd always get the call to go with him. On nights like that, we'd drive to the hospital with all the windows down because Scott was usually a little too drunk to be behind the wheel, so the fresh air would keep him sharp enough to get us there. And the 2 hours in the emergency room and a dozen stitches always sobered him up just enough to get us back home. Nobody ever discussed mental health back then. To be honest, it was probably years later when I even heard those two words put together like that. Back then, you were just weird, odd, or fucked. That was it. Most times, it wasn't because of anything that anyone could help. But if someone asked, the easiest answer was always just, yeah, that guy's fucked up. It's not that people weren't compassionate, but anytime anyone offered help, it was only because they thought you were fucked. I was drawn to people like that. I didn't know why, but I always gravitated to people who seemed hard. people who I could tell were made of rock, people with secrets and scars, the broken and the fucked. That's probably why I fell so in love with Missy and became such good friends with Scott. We gave each other everything and asked for nothing in return. That night at Scott's place, the party was the same as it always was, a total skid fest. Older drunk guys kicking around, Leonard Skinner and Steve Miller Band on repeat, shit beer, and all of us just trying to escape boredom or impress a girl and maybe win a bit of money along the way. Pass the Penny might have been the worst idea of all bad ideas. This wasn't a competition that took place in one night, and the only way to win the cash would be if you showed up the following weekend with proof of your victory. Here's how the game was played. Four or five guys all threw $5 into a hat, and the group chose a treasurer to hang onto the cash until one of us eventually won, with proof. Everyone was handed a 2-inch nail, a penny, and a beer. Each of us had to come up with a very distinct way of marking our penny with the end of our nail. This wasn't easy, especially when you were drinking. Mainly, we just tried to carve a straight line or an X into it. At least that's what I did. When we all had our pennies marked up, it was up to you to remember what you had scratched across the queen's face. Once all the coins had been appropriately vandalized, you'd close hand pass it to the guy on your left, and without looking at it, you'd pop it in your mouth like a children's vitamin and wash it down with a beer. You'd swallow the fucking penny. Now comes the gross part. In order to win, you had to show back up the next week with your penny and get it validated by the guy who handed it to you. Once I swallowed mine, I knew there was no way I was going to spend a week looking through my own shit for $25. I was never going to see that penny or my $5 ever again, and I was totally good with that. At this point, I was just hoping I wasn't going to die, or worse, that I'd have to explain to my dad that I swallowed a penny for a chance to win less than $30 in a stupid game that I invented. Horseshoes was different. It wasn't so much a game as it was a test of strength or courage or stupidity. The trick was this. If you took your cigarette lighter, lit it, and turned it upside down, the flame would heat up the oval-shaped metal cap that covered the flint and housed that little wheel that you had to roll forward every time you used it. If you held it there for a few seconds, the metal would heat up. Then you'd blow out the flame and touch the metal cap to your arm. Just a super quick dab, like a stamp. The hot end of the lighter would leave a little burn on your arm in the shape of a horseshoe. And that was that. No big deal. The burns were nothing more than you'd get accidentally touching your hand against the side of a hot frying pan. It would blister for about a week and disappear shortly thereafter. This was a game I knew I could win. At the party that night, I took a cigarette out, lit it, and smoked about a third of it with my left hand while I held my neon pink lighter upside down with my right. Both the tip of my thumb and the knuckle on my index finger burned and turned black as the metal started to smoke, but I held it. When the wheel burned free and popped right off, I held it. When the cap went from silver to black to red to white, I held it. When I lifted the sleeve of my t-shirt and sank the metal end of it into my shoulder, I held it. When the bottom of the lighter exploded in my hand, I held it. This wasn't a burn that was going to go away in a week or two. I knew I just permanently scarred myself. I knew this was something I was going to have to lie to my mother and everyone else about, probably forever. And I did. But I didn't care. In that moment, everything made sense. The reason I was able to slide the hot end of a lighter into myself so easily was because I wasn't afraid. I was never afraid of pain. My whole life, I had a pretty indifferent relationship with physical pain without realizing how directly tied it was to my inability to deal with what was happening on the inside. That was the second last time I ever burned myself in front of anyone else. Oh, and yes, there was a Pass the Penny winner the following week. One of the older skids showed up with his penny and collected his $25. Nobody cared. The parking lot. I always took the long way home after school so I could smoke two cigarettes. I'd light the second smoke with the butt of the first and slowly scuff and stroll home and join the head rush. So there I was, looking the way I did with the hair, the tight jeans, narrow hips, the whole deal. My brother loves telling this story, by the way. I was about 3 or 4 houses from our place when Rich and his friend Brad drove up behind me before turning into our driveway. As they got a little closer and only seeing me from behind, Brad tapped my brother on the leg so he wouldn't miss out and said, "Nice ass. Wonder what her face looks like." "Dude, that's my brother," Rich said. My dad never really gave a shit about how I looked. I mean, I'm sure there were times that he wished I'd dial it down a bit, but mostly he just got a kick out of it. I'd walk out of my room with a fresh piercing, full-length spandex, cowboy boots with a bandana tied around my thigh, and a t-shirt I had just taken apart and sewn back together. The most I'd get was, "Nah, come on, really?" followed by one of his famous laughs, to which I'd always answer something like, "Oh yes, Pop, really." This drove people nuts. People had such a hard time believing that I was the son of a Marine, which only made me realize how all those people got my dad so very wrong. In those years when I was trying my goddamn hardest to become a teenage glam rock nightmare, I didn't dye my hair a little blonde. I went full platinum. I always made sure my jeans were tight enough to throw people off. You'd know right away these weren't anything you could buy at a regular store. Somehow, going over the top made me less insecure. There was a power to it, but a power I ate a lot of shit for. I've been beat up, had knives pulled on me, got kicked out of more places than you could count, had fathers dump me on behalf of their daughters, been refused service and ripped off, all because of how I looked. Which was fabulous, by the way. The times I heard the word fag, followed by a sharp pain to some part of my body while walking through a crowd, were more than I'd like to remember. Even years later, when I'd get lost alone on the middle of a dance floor or high up on a speaker, while people threw stuff at me and bouncers grabbed at my feet to pull me off, I never went a little. I was always extra, over the top. I never left the house with some major